The Guardian.
Do you ever wonder how we got here? On Earth, that is. Scientists have been trying to answer these kinds of big questions for centuries. And in doing so, have provided frameworks to help explain the world as we see it today.
I've always been interested in deep foundational questions. What are the laws of physics? Where do they come from? What is a human being? Why are we here? Time travel, space travel, destiny of mankind, you know, all that sort of fun stuff.
One such person is the theoretical physicist Paul Davies, who, among other endeavours, has been trying to find the solution to one of humankind's most difficult big questions. What exactly is life?
There are three great origins questions in science: the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin of consciousness. And in my view, the origin of the universe, we figure that out. And I'm a cosmologist, and so I think we understand how the universe came to exist. The origin of life is a tough one, but we're hot on the trail. The origin of consciousness, we don't even know how to frame the question.
In his new book, The Demon in the Machine, Paul looks at whether or not we might have all of the tools necessary to come up with a solution to what life is, or if we might need something fundamentally new, a new kind of physics yet to be discovered, to answer this question. We invited him onto this week's show to talk about living mice, dead mice, and everything in between. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly. Paul, tell me about when you first became interested in physics. How long ago was that? Was that sort of an early love of yours, or was it something that you came to enjoy?
Well, I was born a physicist, so it goes back into the mists of time. There were one or two childhood events that stand out. I was certainly interested in anything that happened in the sky from the age of about 7 or 8, because I can remember one or two episodes, and I can remember reading about atoms. And I was always fascinated with things unseen, the fact that we live in this boring world, and it was boring. I grew up in London in the 50s. It was full of austerity. There was no fun. But this wonderland that was all around us of hidden forces and atoms and stuff in the sky, all that really inspired me. But what I like to tell people, and it's true, is that I was propelled on my scientific career by none other than Margaret Thatcher, who gave me a star atlas when I was 16. This was my O-level prize. She was the MP of the school I went to in North London. So that's another sort of landmark in my career. But I always wanted to be a physicist.
So many scientists have worked extensively on what life does, how do you define sort of life in terms of sort of how it manifests itself, so, you know, reproducing or breathing or those sorts of things. But you're hoping to look at what it is. Why did you want to tackle that? I mean, it's a pretty big question.
It is a big question, and I'm not the first person to ask the question, what is life? There's a famous physicist, Erwin Schrödinger, one of the founders of quantum mechanics, who 75 years ago published a book called What is Life? And I read that book when I was a student, and I thought, well, yes, life is amazing. It's bizarre. To a physicist, it looks just like magic. You think, well, how can these stupid atoms get together and do such clever things? And I've been deeply intrigued by it ever since. Another landmark event in my intellectual journey was in 1983 when Martin Rees at the University of Cambridge convened a conference called From Matter to Life. And that really got me thinking. I met some of the world's greatest biologists and cosmologists and thinkers in general, puzzling over how is it that matter can transform itself into living matter? What is it that gives it that oomph that we associate with life acting so in such a special way? And I've been intrigued by it all that time, but it's only in the last maybe 5-6 years that I've been able to tackle it head on, largely due to some new developments in physics and biology. And so you're quite right, the biologists write wonderful books about what life does, but very few are concerned with what life is as a physical phenomenon.
In the book, Paul says that biology must contain new physics, not just today's physics, applied in new ways or with a slight tweak, but an entirely new kind of physics, new laws.
So I thought long and hard, do I stick my neck out here? And I discussed it with my wife, and she said, yes, you know, if you really do believe this, you should put it in the book and not sort of back away from it. Now, Schrödinger says in his book, we must be prepared to find a new type of physical law. And notice, not just a new law, but a new type of law. So in the starkest terms, this is what we are saying. Can life be explained by physics? And I think the answer is yes, but can it be explained by known physics? And I think the answer is no. We need to extend physics, and not just, I'm not talking about, oh, there's a force we overlooked and it's the life force or something. That's a horrible way of looking at it. It really is back to Schrödinger, a new kind of physical law, that there is a new type of principle, I think, at work in living matter. And so it's going to be something which addresses the question of life's informational properties. And talk to a biologist and everything they say about life is full of informational terminology.
Before we get on to information, which is a key concept in your new book, Paul, I want to pick up on something you mentioned there, something which you have a complete distaste for, and I can understand why. But let's talk about the life force. But this is something which people invoked to explain, well, let's say the difference between a dead mouse and a live mouse. One has the life force and the other very palpably does not. So just talk me through how that concept snuffed it.
Well, I think there are a number of reasons why the life force went out of vogue. One is that it got sort of associated a little bit with spiritualism and other sort of weird 19th century things. It was a scientific theory. That is, it was advanced to explain certain things, particularly embryo development, which seems like a miracle when you look at what happens. And it suffered from the problem of being ad hoc in the sense that a life force applied to living things, but living things were explained by the life force. So unless you could give some other reason, build a meter, for example, that could measure the life force, nobody ever did anything like that. So this whole field called vitalism was really regarded as a terrible dead end. But it does require something in addition to saying, well, it's just a bunch of machines thrown together and it happens to have these amazing properties, that I do think we need something else. And I think that something else involves an abstract concept, but it's not a force. It's informational patterns.
So talk me through how informational patterns are different between a dead mouse and a live mouse. How does information give that mouse a pulse?
Right, put it that way.
Yeah.
Well, first we need to establish that information is important in biology. And if you talk to biologists, they almost use no other words except the informational ones. They'll talk about your DNA being crammed with coded information. The big thing inside our heads called a brain is an information processing system. I don't think anyone would doubt that. But there are many other levels. Cells signal each other chemically. On the other hand, if you ask a physicist, you know, what is life? He'll be told a story in terms of things like energy and entropy and molecular shapes and binding energies and all that type of stuff. So how do we put together this world of molecules that push and pull each other with the world of editing and transcription and so forth? So a favorite definition of life among astrobiologists is it's information coupled to chemistry.
I stuck with my dead mouse, live mouse analogy when pushing Paul further on how this idea of information coupled with chemistry made sense here in the real world.
Well, I wish I could write down a formula. I can just give you the gist of what my colleagues and I really feel is going on, that we think that transitions, for example, from non-life to life or from single cells to multi-celled, that all of these are associated with changes in the architecture of that information. Roughly speaking, and it trips off the tongue, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. There are ways in which you can quantify that, make that quite precise. And we're involved in exactly doing that, looking at computer models in which those effects are illustrated. And so it's that architecture that we think is associated with those major transitions, including the first one from non-life to life. I wish this was a completely worked out program. It's not. It's really more of an agenda to how we should think about it. But I'm sure that the answer lies in that sort of direction.
According to Paul, this new agenda needs to be applied to the mystery of life if we're ever to find an answer as to what it is. And after this break, we'll hear about Paul's own agenda, what he calls the demon in the machine.
I can't sit here and say I have answered Schrödinger's question, what is life, and here is the answer. but I think I've identified the correct way of thinking about this and where the progress is now being made.
We'll be back after this. It's time to focus.
Well, I think that Democrats are going to have to contend with the fact that everything is about Donald Trump.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. This week, we're on a quest to find out what life is, which is as profound a question as they come. Before the break, theoretical physicist Paul Davies mentioned the connection between information and chemistry, something he believes is a key concept if we're ever to solve the mystery of what life is. Which brings us nicely to Paul's eponymous demon of his new book. The title is based on something known as Maxwell's demon, a thought experiment dreamt up by the Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell. At its core, the demon which Maxwell proposes is a sort of little imaginary creature. Remember, this is a thought experiment, which uses nothing more than information about a system to turn disorder into order. Now, if you're familiar with Maxwell's demon, you'll know it caused something of a furore because it went against the second law of thermodynamics, a law which says you can only really go from order to disorder unless you do some hard work and use some energy, something Maxwell's hypothetical demon somehow manages to avoid. I asked Paul to explain the importance of this hypothetical demon.
I always want to say he, and that's very sexist, but it's a mischievous being, so perhaps he is correct, who operates a shutter and can let fast molecules through in one direction and slow molecules in the other, and in an ideal case wouldn't expend any energy to do that, and then would create a temperature difference from which you could run a heat engine or something and do some work. The key concept here is that the demon uses information about the molecules to gain a thermodynamic advantage. So information acts as a type of fuel. It's possible to treat it just like electricity. The demon does it without expending energy by using information instead of electricity. It doesn't violate the letter of the second law of thermodynamics because for the demon to work in a cyclic manner, go on doing more and more and more, its poor brain gets clogged up with the information it garners and has to be brainwashed, or the information in the system that serves as a demon has to be cleared, the register has to be cleared, and that gives you back as much entropy as you have gained from doing this manipulation.
As it turns out, Paul shows that something that comes close to these demons can be found in our own body. For example, cellular ion channels. Essentially, these channels facilitate the movement of charged particles, known as ions, across the cell membrane. It's a process that is vital to life, and nowhere more so than in our brains.
The very fact we're talking means these demons are hard at work in our brains, because the brains are sort of wired like electrical machines, but it's not just electrons flowing along wires as it would be in the equipment we're talking into. Instead, what happens in the axons that connect the neurons together is that there are gates in the membrane, little holes that are gated. The gates open, just like Maxwell wanted his demon to open a shutter, and they'll allow sodium or potassium ions to flow with very high discrimination and almost no energy expenditure. And it's that change in the ionic concentration that represents the signal that travels down the axon and helps us to think. It's very striking that the brain has the capability of a supercomputer, a megawatt supercomputer, and it runs on the energy equivalent of less than a light bulb. And so there's some extraordinary efficiency at the thermodynamic level taking place in our brains.
All of this had me thinking about the dead mouse and the live mouse. The dead mouse, of course, still has ion channels, but unfortunately for the mouse, they're not working anymore. Unlike his alive comrade, who still has these sort of demons working away from within. I was curious to know how information fits into that difference between the two mice. They both have the same machinery, but one is scurrying around and the other one is stone cold. To explain this difference, Paul talks about something called a life meter, something which basically looks at both the hardware, like the ion channels, and the software, which are the informational patterns needed to make those channels function.
Wouldn't it be great if we could measure the degree of aliveness? And of course, you would want to know, has it gone beyond the point of no return? And all this sounds crazy until you come up against, this is a very practical matter in astrobiology. There's a moon called Enceladus, it's a moon of Saturn, and it's got a liquid interior beneath an icy crust. And spewing out from cracks in the surface of that moon are organic molecules. The Cassini spacecraft detected organics. Organics doesn't necessarily mean living. NASA would like to fly a spacecraft through that plume, and then the question is, what should it look for? And this NASA scientist, Chris McKay, was at a workshop where we were talking about these informational patterns and so on, and he said, that's all very well, but what do I put on this spacecraft that is going to discriminate between life and non-life? What is the life meter? Give me a life meter that I can put on this spacecraft. I think most scientists would say, but that's an absurd thing to say. We can't measure almost alive, just like we can't really measure the dead mouse and did it just die or is it still capable of coming back to life. These are concepts we haven't really pinned down, and that's why I think this informational approach is going to answer those questions in a much more precise way. But we don't have the complete worked out program. I often say it's the software approach to life. We could say, well, the hardware is still intact, but you know, the software is corrupted and it's not going to work again.
So looking at information rather than just energy is a different way of looking at life, but it still hasn't really solved the question of the difference between something living and something dead. Is that fair to say?
It's fair to say that we could not, in our present state of knowledge, discriminate, and let's come back to Enceladus, could we say these molecules indicate that they were part of life but no longer are, you know, it's a once living thing, or it's a not quite got there living thing, or yes, it is indeed living. We don't have the answer to that. So what I'm doing in this book is really showing you, this is a glimpse of the future of biology and biophysics. It's where computing and information theory and even quantum physics are coming together to address these very questions. So I think I can't sit here and say I have answered Schrödinger's question, what is life, and here is the answer. but I think I've identified the correct way of thinking about this and where the progress is now being made.
Now, some might argue that fundamentally, you need energy to make those informational systems. When you come back to the dead mouse and the live mouse scenario. So once again, I went to my new friends, the dead mouse and the live mouse, and went back to Paul.
You seem fixated on this dead mouse. you're right that we talk about energy, and nobody would dispute that we have energy flowing through our bodies, but we have information flowing through our bodies as well. And it's not quite a simple matter of saying where the energy goes, the information goes. What we need are laws of physics that can encompass that. But the point about energy is that it's interconvertible. So you can change electrical energy into mechanical energy and gravitational energy and so on, and the total amount is conserved. Same thing with information. I can download a file from my computer onto a flash drive, and then I could put it in an optical fiber and send it as photons and so on. The information is conserved. The substrate in which that information is instantiated can change. But we sort of feel that it's got to have an independent existence if it can be passed on from one system to another, like energy. And clearly there will be a story here that will couple information to energy, but also to chemistry. So maybe that the information-energy link is not the most relevant one, but you're absolutely right to draw attention to the fact that we have traditionally thought in terms of energy, but I think information is much closer to what life is really about.
The last thing I want to ask is just about whether it can solve another knotty issue, which you also alluded to earlier on, which is the question of consciousness, which for many people perhaps is tied to what is life, particularly from a human perspective. We often talk about feeling alive and sort of a heightened sense of consciousness. Just talk me through, can information help to explain what makes us us?
There are three great origins questions in science: the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin of consciousness. And in my view, the origin of the universe, we figure that out. And I'm a cosmologist, and so I think we understand how the universe came to exist. The origin of life is a tough one, but we're hot on the trail. The origin of consciousness, we don't even know how to frame the question properly. And so I have done my best in that chapter to outline why it's such a problem and where I think there's some progress. And one area that I do think there's progress is in applying information theory to the problem of consciousness. And I came up with the analogy as a bit like a committee, that you might have a committee makes a decision. We talk about the committee decided. Well, the committee's a bunch of human beings. Nevertheless, there is collective decision making, and it takes place in a committee. There's information transferred back and forth between members of the committee, and then a consensus is reached. If everyone went to a committee and each independently voted without consulting the others, that would be disintegrated information. A properly functioning committee is integrated, and so its output is, in a sense, a collective effort. And the same thing appears to be going on in the brain. There is a sort of collective or systemic processing of information, and then there's this processing at a lower level, and conscious or not hinges on the extent to which that information processing is integrated, you know, whether it's a cortical column or the whole brain and so on. Very hard thing in practice to measure, but you can see generally the concept, and if you go with that, it will provide answers to questions that philosophers love to ask, like, is a thermostat conscious or is a computer conscious?
Yeah.
It may be that integrated information is not the right one, but it's a brave attempt, and it's the type of thing that I warm to.
The idea that Paul puts forward in his book, that information is the key to life, is an intriguing and beguiling one. But questions still remain about what life really is and what it means to us to be alive. It's a developing field, so it's a case of watch this space. That's it for this week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can. Just email scienceweekly@theguardian.com or tweet @guardianaudio. And a link to Paul's book, The Demon in the Machine, can be found on our website, theguardian.com/podcasts. This week's episode was produced by Danielle Stevens. I'm Nicola Davis. Until next time, goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.